Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, everybody here from Chicago. Hello and welcome to this podcast. In today's segment, we will be talking with Mr. Brian Heilman. He is a solution architect at a leading in data protection firm called Cyber Haven, based in Colorado. Brian, thanks for your time, and let's go and get started.
Hi, Ravi. Thanks for having me. I appreciate to be here.
Oh, thanks for your time. Well, we looked up your bio, did some background snooping on you. Now, we didn't do it like a background check or anything, but you seem to have a really, you know, deep and very, you know, but very varied background in cybersecurity. Can you kind of elaborate on some of the turning points or highlights of your career in cybersecurity?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's dive into that. So I've been in cybersecurity for about 12 years now, primarily focused on data protection. If I even go back before that, I actually started in just an IT role back in about 2007. I was a network administrator for 4 years. So that's actually where I got my IT foundation. At the time, I also went to night school and got a bachelor's degree in the time called information security. Now we call it cybersecurity. And I broke into the cybersecurity field with a company called BEW Global. I was a network security engineer. Specifically, what my job was installing data protection solutions. So back in the day, it was Symantec DLP. It was Forcepoint, which was called WebSense at the time, McAfee, RSA, Proofpoint, a lot of the data protection vendors. And I spent actually 6 years at that company through a variety of different roles. I was, you know, an engineer for a while, also ran the team for about 4 years. And then I went back into being an individual contributor for the last 2 years as a principal security consultant there. And that's really where I got my initial start in cybersecurity. And what was interesting about that is it's all around data protection. And that's where I've always focused my career, and that's where I got my foundation. I then switched from the consulting side over to the sales side. I went over to a company called Digital Guardian. I was a sales engineer over there for about 3.5 years, primarily covering the mountain territory and some of the California territory. And then I went over to Palo Alto Networks. I was over at Palo Alto Networks for 1.5 years. I was a consulting engineer over there, so that was an interesting role. Palo Alto Networks was making a big push for data security, so they went out and hired some data security experts, including myself, and I was essentially an overlay for their sales team in North America, about 900 different sales teams out there that I was helping support on their go-to-market efforts. And then from there, I ended up at Cyber Haven about 9 months ago.
Cool. Awesome. Now, how long has Cyber Haven been in business? And in fact, another question I kind of wanted to segue into, how do you get the name Cyber Haven?
Yeah, good question. So Cyber Haven was founded in like 2016, 2017 timeline. It actually launched in 2019. So that's actually when we actually went out and started getting our first customers. It was actually developed by four computer scientists from the Swiss Research University. So it's interesting, you know, our company started over in Switzerland and, you know, has migrated over, and our headquarters is now out of California. And the name Cyber Haven, I don't actually know the full story around it, but I can tell you, you know, the idea was essentially, you know, we've got some technology around it where we do data tracing and get visibility into a lot of data and help protect data, and we're a location where you can come and actually, you know, solve your cybersecurity issues, specifically your data protection issues.
Okay, so it's kind of like a feeling of safety then, right, I'm assuming?
Yeah, I think so.
Cool, okay, interesting. Does Cyber Haven have any presence in other countries, or are you just local to the U.S.?
Yeah, so we definitely have a big U.S. focus. That's where we've been building a lot of our resources from a go-to-market strategy. So our sales team and a lot of our marketing team is all in the U.S. base, but we are expanding that go-to-market strategy. We've added resources over in the U.K. They're covering, you know, really the whole European region and doing some in the Asia Pacific region as well. And what's interesting about the company itself is we're very much a worldwide company. So like I mentioned, our developers came from Switzerland. Two of the founders still live over there. One is over in the U.S. And a lot of our developers are spread across Europe as well. We have a big presence of developers in Ukraine. We've got developers spread across Europe, and we're even, you know, have developers in the U.S. So it's a very diverse, you know, development team that we've put together. And I think it also gives us great, you know, perspectives on different ways to solve different challenges. So I think it's been a great experience so far.
Has the conflict in the Ukraine had any impact on your business or anything like that, or since you said you had some developers there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when I started, I've been with CyberHaven about 9 months, and when I first started, yeah, we did see some. There was still some impact happening. You know, the developers may have had to, you know, go offline to move around or deal with the challenges of the conflict they're dealing with, and even we had, you know, our company kickoff a few months ago, and almost the whole company was able to come join us, but the Ukraine team, just due to travel restrictions, was, you know, had to join us remote. So it's been a challenge, not only, you know, they're dealing with their, you know, local conflict, but then they also have travel restrictions, so we couldn't actually get together with the whole team. Next year, we're looking at putting our company kickoff somewhere hopefully closer to them, so we can figure out how to get them to join us, because they've gone through a lot, and they're very resilient, and it's pretty amazing. You know, they're able to continue putting in the hours and work, and the work that they produce is just excellent.
Now, who is the typical customer base that you're trying to target? Is it the SMBs, the federal government, Fortune 500, or perhaps a conglomeration of all three of them?
Yeah, so CyberHaven has typically been focused on the small to medium, and that's been our approach right now. And what I mean by small to medium, usually that's small kind of falls out. Usually we see customers start, you know, adopting it when they have over around 500 users. It's kind of like our beginning point. It's even getting up to that 1,000 user point. And then it grows up to, you know, the 6 to 8,000 user range has been kind of our target market. That is expanding. So we have added in some larger organizations, you know, over that 10,000 mark. Actually, some of them over the 20,000 mark at this point. So we are expanding into enterprise. We've spent the last 6 months from a development standpoint working on enterprise-focused features, and those features are things like RBAC and additional audit logs and features that are needed for large enterprises to adopt our solution, utilize our solution. And myself personally, I'm actually a solution architect, and my role here is to help get us into that enterprise. So I focus on customers that are actually over 5,000, and I've got, you know, connections from my past experience with those enterprises. I understand what use cases and challenges they're dealing with, and that's been my focus, is, you know, making sure that our product, which it is in a very good state right now, ready to go and talk to those enterprises. And continue to understand what their new challenges are and keep ahead of those as well.
Awesome, cool. Let's do a deeper dive into your product line. You've got something called the data detection and response. Can you go over that in more detail, and how is it available? Is it on-prem, in the cloud, or both?
Yeah, so data detection and response is a term that really we came up with here at Cyberhaven. Our marketing team and our CEO, Howard, came up with that term, data detection and response. And really the way that they looked at it is, you know, when EDR first came out, endpoint detection and response, really that came out to help replace the traditional antivirus that was static, looking at, you know, just a dictionary of files that were potentially malicious. And EDR became more dynamic in that type of detection. Same thing with data detection response. We want to move some of the more traditional, you know, products, and those products specifically would be something like endpoint data loss prevention. So those are tools out there that help protect data when they're down at your endpoint. And a lot of those tools were built and focused on compliance-driven use cases. And so some of those would be, you know, like those vendors are very much in that compliance realm. But what we are seeing is that there's also insider risk management, IRM is what that's called. And IRM vendors were very much focused on behavior of what users were doing and looking for anomalies to create alerts. And what we found is our opportunity was to help combine both of those together. So you take the DLP and insider risk management, you combine those together, and we come up with a solution that gets deep visibility into all data activity on the endpoints. We can understand more file types. So instead of just looking at it from a compliance standpoint, our visibility gives us the capability to protect things like intellectual property and especially unstructured intellectual property. And I'll give you an example. So let's say we go and we talk to a manufacturing company or maybe a design company. And what these companies are trying to protect isn't necessarily PII, so it's not personal identifying information. It may not be credit card information. Sure, there might be a little bit of that they're like, yeah, we probably don't want our employee data leaving our organization, so that might be something they want to do, but it's not necessarily a high enough risk for the business to go out and buy a product. What is enough high risk is if their intellectual property, specifically, let's say their design files, those might be CAD diagrams, they might be Photoshop files, they may be blueprints, they may be the secret formula. We also have seen a lot of things in like oil and gas where they've got like drilling maps and information around critical infrastructure and things that give them an advantage in the market. And those are types of documents that are very hard to protect with the traditional approach of just saying, okay, I'm going to break it open and look for a keyword of, you know, confidential or secret. Because if it's a Photoshop file of the newest image of a character that's about ready to go into production, that is something that you may not be able to protect using a keyword. You need to protect that by understanding what that data is through its whole life cycle. And the way that we do this is through something we call data lineage. And we look at how users are interacting with file from their very beginning, how they're being collaborated with, what applications are touching it. And if those files start going outside of those parameters that we've considered, you know, the normal behavior. So, for example, let's say someone takes that new that new image, that new character, and they download that, let's say, from an internal SharePoint site. Well, that's normal. They open it in Photoshop. They start editing it. They maybe do some changes. They then export that to a PNG. Well, that's normal. That's all part of their behavior. But you need to understand that. You need to follow it through its whole life cycle. And then if that user takes that PNG and let's say by mistake they go and they try to attach it to their Outlook, but by mistake they were signed in their personal Outlook account and not the corporate account, well, our technology and our agent could actually see that behavior and we could actually stop that from happening. So that's how we can use data lineage to understand exactly how the full life cycle of data is being interacted with. And if it goes outside of the norm, we can provide an alert. We can provide education down to the end user, letting them know, hey, you probably shouldn't have do that. Or we can even block that from leaving altogether and tell the end user, hey, sorry, you're not allowed to send this new character that's about ready to be released out to the public. We need to keep this internal.
Oh, wow. Wow, it sounds pretty intense. Now, is your solution, is it again, on-prem, or is it in the cloud mostly, or does the customer have a choice of how they want to deploy it?
So from an architecture standpoint, we are a SaaS product. Everything is currently hosted up in the cloud. Specifically, we host our back end in Google, so in GCP. We leverage a lot of the GCP products. So we use things like their global load balancing capabilities for agent connections. We use their back end like BigQuery for our graph database. To put all these, you know, millions of events together and stitch them all together. A lot of that processing takes place up in the cloud. And so what that does is because we've offloaded so much of the processing and the, you know, analytics and the incident management and the content inspection, because we've offloaded that over into our back end up into the cloud, is what it's allowed us to do is have a lighter weight agent. So our agent supports Windows and Mac, and that agent can become more lightweight because we've offloaded a lot of that processing to the cloud. And that's also one of the, you know, the advantages of our products is that lightweight agent in that, you know, we're not necessarily doing some of the heavier processing down at the endpoint that vendors, you know, typically that was the approach to do everything at the endpoint. But you know, when we're going after these customers that want to protect things like intellectual property, like I mentioned, let's say it's a developer, we can't impact the developer's capability to get their job done. We still want to be able to watch what they're doing and potentially provide controls. But the most important thing for a lot of organizations is just visibility, just getting an understanding of what users are doing with their data and if there is a potential that those users are putting any data at risk.
Okay, excellent. Well, now, do you have any customer success stories you can share with us without giving any, you know, obviously any confidential information or any use cases or so?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of our larger customers that we, you know, have case studies for and everything, they definitely use our product for something I mentioned around protecting design diagrams and specifically designs of a physical type device that they're going to manufacture. And so what this customer came to us with was saying, hey, we've had some challenges in the past where some of our designs have been stolen. And they've been specifically stolen by manufacturing firms in other countries. And these other countries have got a hold of our designs. They've taken these designs, and they've started designing our device prior to us even getting to that stage. So they're getting close to beating the actual company to market with their own device. And so the organizations came to us and said, like, hey, we need to be able to stop this. We need to be able to understand what our designers are doing with these devices. We still need to have employees and people to collaborate with this data. But if this data starts walking out the door, we want to be able to stop that. So the moment they installed our agent, we started providing complete visibility on what users were doing with these designs of these devices, how they were interacting with it, how they were collaborating with these designs, and then looking and seeing where the designs were going, where they may not, you know, have expected. And we saw data start leaving the organization through channels that, you know, that they probably knew were happening, but they didn't have visibility in it. Things like just people uploading it to traditional webmail, you know, personal Gmail, personal, webmail in different countries. Also, cloud storage was another one that they found. So people would install a sync client. An example of that would be like the Dropbox or Google Drive sync client. And what's interesting about those sync clients and where they were having a lack of visibility there is those sync clients use end-to-end encryption. And they have cert pinning technology built in, so you cannot decrypt that traffic at the network layer. And if you do try to decrypt it, it breaks the application. And because this organization wanted their users to still be able to use those apps, they had a lack of visibility in what data was going through those sync clients. But our agent was able to provide that visibility. And if we saw design diagrams going into those sync clients, then we could stop that. And we could say, hey, you're not allowed to put data in your Dropbox or your Google Drive sync client. These are design files. That's not allowed. Please use our corporate OneDrive, and that's the only location that this data can be stored. And we can provide that education directly to those end users in real time. And they have seen a big reduction in the amount of data that has been leaving the organization.
Excellent. Wow. Cool. Do you have any other stories you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, so that's a customer that actually was a customer for us for a while. There's also some customers that I've been working with since my time here in about the last 9 months, like I mentioned. There's two verticals that have been very interesting where we've been able to provide some strong value for businesses. One is with the private equity and like the fintech companies. We've seen a big increase in capabilities to provide protection for them. And what's interesting about their business models is they don't necessarily have the same compliance requirements as, let's say, a large bank. They have some large banks that may be telling them, like, hey, you need to have data protection tools in place. But their data that they're trying to protect is things like, if it's fintech, for example, it may be things like source code. So actually they've got like automated investment tools, and those automated investment tools have a lot of algorithms and source code that are behind them that are unique to that organization. It's their secret sauce. And in order to keep that protected, it's not just looking for, bank account information and customer information like a normal bank would be looking for. It's looking for formulas and algorithms and information that's harder to define and protect. So that's an example of fintech. And the other one that's been interesting, and it's been around for a long time, but law firms. And law firms, they have an interesting challenge in that they have their clients that are saying, you need to be able to protect our data to do business with us. And that's been that way for a long time. Back when I was doing implementations at my original job, I actually did a lot of law firms when I worked for IntelliSecure as a consultant. And we would deploy these products, and our approach would be every single file that would leave the organization, we would break it open, we would inspect the content of the file, and we would look for keywords. We would look for, like, bank names and client names and information in there like confidential or like certain terms. So we would do it very driven on keywords and terms and dictionaries. And that's the way that we just went about it, and that worked, but it didn't necessarily scale, and it didn't work well, especially if those keywords were removed from a document, then it could just walk out the door. And so what we've been seeing with law firms specifically is a lot of them use document management systems, things like iManage as an example. So that's where they keep all of this client information, and it allows the law firm to interact with the data collaboratively. So you can have additional law attorneys, you can have different people that are working on the documentation in this iManage platform. But what we can do from a visibility standpoint is we could say, hey, anything that comes out of this application, whether this be through a web browser or a client app that's installed on the workstation, we want to watch the documents that are coming out of this and get an understanding of how people are interacting with them. And this data, we can consider it just sensitive based on where it was stored. And we could say, hey, that data is allowed to go back to the customer. It's allowed to go to certain partners. But the moment they try to take that data and send it somewhere, outside of the norm, we could provide those protection layers and those educational layers and say, hey, attorney, you're allowed to send this data, back to the client, but you're not allowed to send this to your personal, email. Even though you feel like you own this data, it's something you probably don't own. You built this while you're employed here, and we get to retain this data. And that same, you know, concept, we see it, you know, relevant in law firms, but we also see it relevant sometimes in the medical field as well, where, you know, researchers say, well, I've done the research, I own this data. And it's like, well, wait a second, you don't necessarily own it. Sure, your thoughts and things that went into it you own, but everything you've built here is owned by our organization. And so we're gonna need to keep that, and we want to keep it protected.
Wow. That's pretty intensive, like an audit trail of where the data is going. Now, to kind of get back to your company again, you know, Brian, there's a lot of cyber vendors. I think last count, there's like 2,000-plus vendors, cyber vendors here in the U.S. And we know that data privacy is now starting to become a hot-button issue, you know, with the GDPR or CCPA. What separates Cyberhaven from the other vendors offering data loss or data prevention services or, you know, anything within that realm? Or in other words, why should I come to you, Brian, and say, hey, can you protect my data versus these 10 other companies?
Great question. So really where we the foundation of our product was that data lineage that I mentioned. And data lineage is really one of our biggest differentiators in the market. And the reason for that is because we're taking millions of events and we're stitching those together to come up with an understanding of a full data lifecycle. So this gives us the ability to classify and protect important data without the need to actually break it open and look for content within it. We can still do that. So if someone comes to us and says, hey, we've got a compliance use case, sure, we can help with that. We can break it open. We can look inside of it. But then we can go above and beyond that and start looking at where data comes from, who's using it, what are the applications that are touching it. We can also help with things like encrypted apps. So you mentioned, you know, there's a lot of different vendors out there that do a lot of different things. If I look at DLP, it almost kind of breaks up into four different categories right now. You've got your DLP for discovery. You've got your cloud DLP. You have your endpoint DLP. And then you've got your network DLP. The network DLP vendors, those are some very large vendors that are out there that are helping with, you know, big use cases like SASE, which is secure, you know, the secure service edge and stuff like that. And those are some very large vendors. I worked for one, like I mentioned, Palo Alto Networks. And those vendors are very good at network security. And they've now started layering in things, like I mentioned, like data security. And those work very well for things that you can get visibility into, things that you can decrypt. And there's a lot of use cases for network DLP. Where I see that we start getting an advantage on those, though, is, like I mentioned, there's a lot of apps nowadays that are starting to use end-to-end encryption, and we no longer can decrypt all the traffic on our network. Things like third-party client apps, so think about things like WeChat, Signal, end-to-end encrypted chat applications, those sync applications that I mentioned. In order to get visibility into those tools, you have to have an agent down at the workstation. And then the other thing I think of is I mentioned the cloud DLP and the discovery DLP. Those absolutely have some use cases that we can dive into further about, you know, some of the buzzwords and some of the things that's going on in the industry. But I still think even if you go out and you understand where all of your data is and you get a great inventory of that data, if you want to go to the next phase of saying, okay, well, now I need to protect it and I don't want that data to leave my organization, the way that users are interacting with that data in almost every organization is going to be down at their workstation. So developers are going to pull that data down. There's going to be, you know, designers, the use cases I mentioned where they're, you know, editing, let's say, a Photoshop file or a CAD document or any of those documents, those are all taking place down at the endpoint. So in order to be able to protect that data, it's going to move from at rest and in the cloud down to the workstation. Users are going to be interacting with it. And in order to keep that data then protected, you need to have that visibility and the capability down at the endpoint to protect that. And we're not the only vendor that is sitting, you know, down at the endpoint providing protection, but I will say we are one of the strongest vendors when it comes to data lineage and the providing protection capabilities for all file types and all different, a lot of those different use cases that I mentioned. And what that does is it gives us a lot more broad coverage and granular controls. And it also keeps the agent more lightweight than a lot of the vendors that are out there today down at the endpoint.
Okay, excellent. Now, switching back to your company again, Cyberhaven, how do you reach out to clients? Do you reach out to them directly with the direct sales model, or do you primarily like rely upon a VAR partner kind of model to get your clients?
Yeah, so we, when the company first started, it was a lot of direct to business. So we were doing a lot of direct business, and we were, you know, out there trying to get, you know, direct relationships with customers and sell directly to customers. In the last year, so even prior to me joining, they've made a big shift into the channel area. So we've been working with a lot of the large VAR vendors, there's a list of, you know, 10 different ones we're working with. Some of the big ones, you know, that you can imagine are things like GuidePoint and the GuidePoint's one of our largest ones. We also have some of the more, you know, specialty ones like Evotech and I'm drawing to mind like DurSec and some of the more specialty ones out in the West. That's been a big focus for the last year, like I mentioned, but even more so in the last 6 months. We have really made a commitment that we want 100% of our new business to go through the channel. So we are making a big push in that, and that's going to be one of our growth strategies as well, is working with those channel partners to grow our relationship and help utilize their relationships that they have with customers to help grow and continue to expand our business through the channel. And it's interesting. You see some of the big vendors doing this push as well. Right before I left Palo Alto Networks, we had a big push to become more channel friendly. So it's not just us that are doing this. We know that the amount of relationships that our channel partners have out there is critical. They have the ability to understand a full customer's challenges and their full landscape, and they can then bring in the correct vendors to help solve those use cases. And what we have found is if we can work with those channel partners, like educating the, you know, solution architects there that they have and getting a better, you know, relationship with them directly and educating them on here's the landscape, here's where we fit in, here's our specific use cases we can help with, then they're able to then turn around and understand their full portfolio to say, like, okay, I've got, you know, 50 customers I'm working with. It would make sense for you to go talk to these five because they've got an initial project going on in the next 6 months. You know, there's, you know, some others that, oh yeah, there would be a good fit for these other five, but you know what? They just signed new contracts. They've just renewed that. Their budget cycle hasn't started yet. So let's wait and go talk to them maybe 6 months down the road. So the channel partner has a very, you know, big view of that with their customers, that sometimes when you're trying to go directly to the customer, it becomes a little bit harder. Now, that being said, of course, we have our marketing efforts bring Cyberhaven into the eyes of many customers directly, right? So I would say a lot of customers are still coming to us directly, and in that case, we will then loop in a channel partner to help lead that deal for those customers that are coming to us directly. And a lot of those marketing efforts, and actually one of our biggest one that we've been promoting lately, is around the things like ChatGPT. So we've seen a big increase in people actually putting data into those type of applications like ChatGPT that are sensitive data that you know, they just want, you know, a developer may want their code to be reviewed, or, you know, someone's like, you know, can you rewrite this document for me? And they'll send it in there not knowing that that'll potentially become part of the ChatGPT model, and it could actually be putting data at risk. And that's actually been a big driver for the last about month for us, from a marketing standpoint, we've seen a big increase in activity regarding that.
Cool. Now, just to, well, now that you brought that up, what do you think about ChatGPT? Have you actually used it yourself personally or for your business needs?
So I have. I was one of the, you know, when I first saw it starting to blow up, I'm a big Reddit user. So, you know, you started seeing people talk about it all over in Reddit. And I was like, oh, I need to go check this out, right? So yeah, I absolutely have used it. I've tested with it. I actually run a webpage called dlptest.com. I've owned that and managed that for many years. I built it back in the day when I was a consultant. And it was interesting. When ChatGPT first came out, I was like, hey, you know what? I should just see tell it to rewrite the content on my webpage. And, you know, I sent it my current text, and I said, hey, rewrite this for me. And it actually was very impressive. It not only rewrote it, but it actually brought in additional content that I was like, wow, okay, this is not only just looking at my my content that I fed it through my webpage, but it's also pulling in relevant content from additional sources into its rewrite of my content on my webpage. Now, I didn't turn around and just use that content. Because if you follow, you know, things like Google, they aren't necessarily pumped that people are out there just writing web pages using just ChatGPT. So now other web pages have popped up. That one of them that I actually have used is Originality AI, and now you've got these tools that can detect if it was written by one of these chatbots. And if your web page is just, you know, showing like 90% written by a chatbot, Google won't rank it as well. So it's become a very, you know, even in the web page creation world, it's become a great tool, but also a tool where you've got to be careful and not just be using that only. You've got to put some originality into your content. And I haven't used it for anything like source code or anything like that. I have done like the whole like test where you can just say like, hey, write an application for me, and sure enough, right, it'll write an application for you. But honestly, my background has been mostly from like a development standpoint on the web page side of things, not necessarily app development. But I do think it's a very powerful tool, and I think that it's interesting. We have some enterprise customers that are now paying for an enterprise version of ChatGPT. And what that does is it allows their users to continue to use the tool, but it's now a closed model. So if people are putting sensitive information into it, that's okay now, as long as they're using their corporate account. So that's been another big use case for us is those enterprise customers are telling us like, okay, well, we want them to go use the tool, but only use the tool if they're using their enterprise account. So we need to be able to tell the difference between what account they're using and if it's personal, limit it. If it's enterprise, then allow them to put that sensitive data in.
Yeah. As a technical writer, I think, yeah, ChatGPT has definitely made some controversy, especially when it comes to like the creative people, you know, like the novelists and the science fiction writers, when they use that to create content solely. And then I know that I've self-published quite a bit off the Kindle direct publishing, I think, from Amazon. And I think they're starting to crack down on content written explicitly by ChatGPT. So I think this is going to be a interesting conversation topic definitely down the road. But anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure you being a content writer, I know you write a lot of content. You've got a lot of books published. I'm sure that this has changed the dynamic of your world as well. And there's probably a lot of imposters out there trying to get away with, you know, using a chatbot to write massive amount of content that they may not really actually know much about it all.
I you know, to be honest, I've never even tried ChatGPT yet. I've got to write a white paper for that for a client here in the next week. But I don't know. I mean, I'm tempted to try it out, but I believe in just doing things the old-fashioned way, you know. Just write, you know, what you know and just research on Google. But that's just me. Anyway, now, data security, I mean, as we know, that's, as I said before, it's a hot-button topic, you know, with these data privacy laws. And every country cannot come up with their own thing, each state kind of coming up with their own set of privacy laws. What do you think is going to be the biggest issue, and how is this all going to evolve in the coming years, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that data security right now is in a little bit of a innovation stage. And primarily I say that because there's a lot of investments going on in data protection. There's a category that's been deemed by Gartner called DSPM, and that's a you know, field where it's all about providing visibility into where sensitive data is stored, who has access to it, how it's being used, what the posture is of that data, that application that data is being stored in, and you know, the term is data security posture management. So it kind of makes sense that, you know, that's what it's providing visibility into. And those vendors have kind of replaced the more traditional data at rest type use cases where they're, mm-hmm. you know, going in and scanning data and telling you where it is. These new vendors and these innovative vendors have really, you know, broken into that realm. And there's a lot of investments going on in there from a funding standpoint. I actually have a talk that I'm giving later this week, and I've got a few other times that I'm giving this talk about navigating the ecosystem of modern data protection. And this is something that I dive into in that talk. And it's very interesting. In that data discovery market, there's been over $1 billion worth of funding in just the last 3 years into that field. So what that's done is it's created a ton of innovation and also a ton of vendors. So you mentioned, you know, I think you mentioned there's like 2,000 vendors out there. I think just in that one field in my research, I found over 20 different vendors that are all in that single field that have all got money and funding behind them. So I think in that field, what you're going to see is going to be maybe, you know, a handful of those, maybe like five of those become, you know, very well-funded, very big brands. I think you also see acquisitions taking place. So we've seen this in the past, right, where you've got innovation take place in a certain field, and then all of a sudden acquisitions start taking place to grab that technology and integrate it into a larger platform. So, you know, companies that are, you know, looking to get into more into data protection in order to keep up with that, a lot of times that takes place through acquisition. The company I was at, Palo Alto Networks, is very well known for this. They are an acquisitioner. They acquire a lot of companies in order to keep up with technology and to break them into new markets. So I would see organizations like Palo Alto going out and doing acquisitions in this field. You know, we could probably see some consolidation of vendors as well. And I think that that's been a big indicator. And what's been interesting and where we sit at Cyberhaven is we actually are sitting down at the endpoint, and we've seen a little bit less funding down at that side of things, and part of the reason for that, I think, in my opinion, is it's a harder use case to go out and solve and be good at. When you're building an agent that is looking for all to protect all data through data lineage, and you know, have no limitations and have a lightweight agent, it's a lot harder of a use case to go solve for and to build for. And we do see some funding still taking place in that field, but not nearly as much as in the DSPM space. And I think the reason for that is the way that they integrate is through APIs. So they say, okay, you just need to go tie us in through APIs to AWS and Azure and GCP and also your SaaS providers like your Office 365 and your Salesforce and your Dropbox and your Box, and you know, they've got a list of, you know, 30 to 50 different applications that they support. They even support going in and scanning some of their old on-prem stuff. So you can scan things like databases and network shares and all this stuff. And so from an integration standpoint, it's out of band, meaning it's doing the scanning through APIs and connections, you know, DB connections and stuff like that. So from an integration standpoint, yes, it is a little bit easier. But like I mentioned, one of the gaps that they have is, yeah, they're going out and they're providing a ton of intelligence and a lot of interesting aspects of where data lives. And if you have compliance requirements, this is usually one of the requirements. Like you mentioned, you know, if it's compliance driven, there are compliance requirements that say you need to know where all of your sensitive data is stored. You need to know where all of your compliance data is stored and where it lives. And you need to prove to us that it is protected in that repository that you know, compliance data lives in. So from a compliance standpoint, I 100% think that those tools are going to be needed and that they're going to continue to grow. I think that the next area that, you know, is going to continue to grow is where we're sitting. And that's going to be, you know, the endpoint protection area, because these vendors are providing, like I said, a lot of interesting data and telemetry about where your data is stored and making sure that it is secure in its storage bucket, wherever that may be. But the moment that it leaves the cloud or that it leaves the SaaS app or that it leaves the database, that's where they start losing their visibility. Where I began my story when I was over at BEW Global that then turned into IntelliSecure, I was implementing probably one of the biggest products in data protection, and that was Symantec DLP. It was like the largest vendor and the largest market share was held by Symantec DLP. They were then acquired by Broadcom, and I would say they kind of lost a little bit of their innovation edge. But that product is still used by a lot of enterprise customers. And what's interesting about that, Symantec DLP, is it was a platform. It was a platform that did everything through a single platform. So it had your endpoint, it had your discovery, it had your network, it had everything together. And what I see is that some either companies like us, Cyberhaven, we're going to go try to build platforms. You'll see some of the larger vendors try to build platforms because the first vendor that really gets a platform that combines all of this together will probably have a market edge on everyone else. And we may see the next vendor become the replacement of Symantec DLP. And I'm betting that's Cyberhaven, whether through that's our own innovation or acquisition or whatever that may be, becoming that platform of choice.
Okay, excellent. Now, as we come to the last part of our show, I just want to touch based on some basic cyber issues or other topics or broad category. One of them is the Internet of Things. And, you know, that's where everything's all kind of connected together in the virtual and physical worlds. I find the proposition to be very scary. I think, you know, it just increased the attack surface for the cyber attacker. You know, we've got smart homes, smart cars, and God knows what else is smart. What are your thoughts on the IoT? I mean, do you have a smart home yourself?
Yeah, so I think IoT is something that consumers love to have. And the reason is because it makes our lives easier to have things that are connected. And an example of that would be Alexa. And I have an Alexa in my house. I actually have two of them. And I will say my daughter, she loves to use it. She loves to walk up to the device and say, "Hey Alexa, play Katy Perry, play Taylor Swift, play whatever is on her mind at the moment of song or artist that she wants to listen to." And that's the primary thing that she uses for it. But think about that back in our time, right? If we wanted to go listen to an artist, we had to go grab the CD collection and look for it, or maybe go to Napster and find the MP3, and maybe you had to download five different versions of it because the first four were some dude recording it from his radio, and then you're worried about, you know, you're stealing people's music and all this stuff. And the simplification of walking up to a device and saying, hey, play this artist, and it just starts playing, it is really something that I you know, that I think that is very relevant. Now, what does this add from a security standpoint? It's absolutely a risk having this on my network. So what I have to do is due diligence as myself is I've built network segmentation into my network at my house. And I think that more users that are privileged users in their environment absolutely need to consider this. I think that they should have a network segmentation where they make sure that they're buying a router that has capabilities for this, and they put their work devices and their devices that have sensitive data that they're processing with on one network. I have my work network. The work computer that I'm using today is on that network. And then I have my other network that's my home network. That's where I've got my Alexa and my Roku to watch my, you know, streaming TV and my, you know, other devices. I think I've got, I've got my security camera device. I've got that on that network as well. So some of those I've got segmented off. And there's also one thing I have to just, you know, always say is like, I consider having the devices of these as a privilege, but I also consider them a risk, even on their own segmented network. So an example of that is my Alexa. I actually have the one that has the camera on it. The camera lens is closed. I don't allow that to be open. Same thing with my home camera system. It is connected to the internet. And because of that, I do not have any cameras inside of my house. I have them in my perimeter, outside perimeter, for, you know, surveillance purposes, but not anything inside, with the understanding that these devices have the potential to get hacked. And if someone is looking inside of them, I want to make sure that first they can't get to my work computer unless they do break into my router and break into my network segmentation, which that's harder for them to do if they look for the more easy target. And then the other aspect of just my personal privacy with these devices.
Okay, excellent. Now, we've talked a lot about, you know, we've talked about AI, ChatGPT just recently. Now, AI, that's, you know, a big buzzword, a huge buzzword right now in cyber and even becoming, you know, just about every industry as well. AI is, you know, I think a lot of vendors just use that to pump their products, and I think a lot of customers fall for that. What are your thoughts on this misuse of the AI term in the cyber world or data privacy world that you're in?
Yeah, absolutely, and I agree with you. It's used a lot in our industry to talk about how a product can use AI to automate everything, and you don't have to worry about, you know, ever touching this tool again, and that's like a pipe dream, right? I just don't see that necessarily being a viable solution always. I think at times you're always going to need human interaction and human intelligence to understand what's happening within an organization, because one of the challenges I feel these tools have is they're built on generic models to understand what is risk. And if you walk into 10 different businesses, they're going to have 10 different ideas of what is risky in that environment. So until we get to a place where you can actually train these models on what is specific within that environment of risk, that, then I think that they're never going to be to a point where they're fully automated. I do think that there's a lot of innovation going in that space. An example of this would be a product like Azure, right? When I was at Palo Alto Networks, we had a big push for our automation within certain workflows to help streamline analysts' job. So it wasn't necessarily that it was taking away their job, but what it can do is it can help streamline certain functions. So an example was one of the workflows we built there was if there was an alert, let's say a data loss prevention alert that took place. Let's say a user took PII data and they posted it to their personal Gmail. Well, using automation, we could do a few things. I could look up who that user was and what department they're in. I could also look up who their manager was. I could also automate sending maybe an alert to their manager through Slack or Teams saying, hey, just so you know, one of your users just sent out personal identifying information. Is that okay? Is that normal business process? And if they respond back like, yes, it's normal, then we could build in another workflow that said, oh, well, let's mark this as a false positive automatically. The business owner has accepted this risk. Or if they said no, then we could actually create an incident that an analyst then needs to go and look at. So there is room for putting automation in, absolutely. And even here at Cyberhaven, we're starting to build in more ML-driven policies. And the way we're doing that is we're looking at anomaly detection, so taking a baseline of what a normal user does over a time period within an organization or within a specific Active Directory group, and then comparing that to their peers and seeing if they're deviating off of that. And if they deviate off of that, it can be an indicator, but it may not be the only indicator. It may be just one signal that says like, oh, okay, this is of interest. And maybe we start saying, okay, is it of interest because they deviated off the norm, or is it of interest because they deviated off the norm and they sent out sensitive data? And that's where we think that this is really going to start providing value with our customers and our product, is looking at anomaly detection and then tying it back to what is the data the company wants to keep secure.
Okay, excellent. Now, back in 2019, and backtrack a few years, you know, we heard that COVID was coming out in China, and we all thought it was just going to stay there and be contained there, but COVID-19 really changed the world upside down, probably, 10 times over. You know, we've seen a lot of bad things happen, but some good things happen, too, and one of these is the remote workforce. What was once thought would happen 4 or 5 years, we saw it happen, like, in 3 months. What are your thoughts on the remote workforce? Do you think this is going to be something that's going to be here for a long time, permanent? And are you guys remote at Cyberhaven also? Or?
Yeah, definitely. So from a, COVID impact, I was working at Palo Alto Networks at the time. I've been personally a remote worker since 2017 when I first moved into sales. And what's interesting is, the sales workforce that's out there, both sales engineers and salespeople, AEs, territory managers, a lot of those people have been remote for a long time. So in the sales world, it wasn't that big of a shift, right? But for office workers, people that were used to going into office every day, it was an absolute massive change, right? And actually, at Palo Alto Networks and many vendors that were positioned in a great spot to help address keeping your remote networkers or your remote workers connected and secure, we saw it was a boom period, right? We saw all these remote workers go, and then we saw them say, oh, wait, we need to keep them connected to our infrastructure, but we also need to keep them secure. And that's where you saw the big, explosions of things like SASE, and SSE and those, network terms that are out there talking about, keeping your, secure service edge and elements like that came out of that. And I think it's absolutely something that's going to stick around, right? I don't see the younger generations accepting the fact that they need to be in an office to be productive. And me personally, I don't see that either. When I was a consultant and not on the road, we were in the office. So I went into the office for 6 years every day that I was not on the road. And what I found interesting is when I was in the office, yes, there was more collaboration going on, and there was probably more, team bonding going on. But what I didn't see increase was my productivity. My productivity actually plummeted. I was not productive at all because I was spending so much time being collaborative, but that being collaborative also took me off task all the time. And because I was off task all the time, I didn't have necessarily time that I could just sit down and focus on a task for an hour. It was more like sit down and focus on a task for 15 minutes and then get distracted and go do something else. And then that task could take, twice, maybe three times as long. where I see nowadays people sit there and they turn off all their collaboration apps. They turn off their Slack notifications. They close their email, and they'll sit there and they'll work for an hour or two on a task, and they'll get that done with no distractions. And that's possible because they're working at home. There's no one that can just walk up to them and disrupt that time. And honestly, like, the flexibility for organizations to be competitive, especially in the cybersecurity market, I think that they're going to have to offer remote work or at least hybrid work as a flexibility for, you know, high-performing employees.
Right. Yeah,
I agree with you on that. I'm a remote worker. That's the way I want it to be. I don't mind going to the office every once in a while, but I like working from home, and especially this summer steering people. But anyway, one thought about data privacy. There's this issue now of cybersecurity insurance for businesses. It's a complex issue. It's not like buying car insurance or medical insurance. You know, a lot of the insurance carriers are now really clamping down on security or on the requirements. They want, like, SMB owners or even any business owner to kind of, you know, do their own assessments and prove that they have the right controls in place before a policy is even awarded. Have you come across the issues of cyber insurance with your clients, or has your company done that? Come across any issues with their clients also?
So with cyber insurance, there are some requirements that they say, hey, if you have a breach and we do an audit, you need to prove that you have certain controls in place. Our tool can help with that type of an audit if you came through and said, like, hey, you know, you need to prove that you can keep data protected down at the endpoint, that then absolutely we could help with that, and that's something we could help with an audit and help you pass that audit as well. I think what's interesting about, you know, the market of cyber insurance is that it's not always well-defined of, like, okay, you need to have this tool, this tool, this tool. It's just like you need to show that you had some controls in place. I almost leave it up to the customer to say, like, you know, what controls are most critical for you. We try to tie this back to things like business risk. You know, what is your business risk? Is your business risk that you're going to fail an audit? Is your business risk that you need to keep intellectual property protected? And you know, if it's the latter, if it's, you know, oh, well, I need to protect intellectual property, then usually we're a very good fit right out of the gate. If you say, like, oh, I've got a compliance requirement and I need to, you know, meet all these different, you know, check marks, we'll probably be part of that, and we'll probably have a, you know, an aspect of those check marks that we meet. But there's other solutions that you'll probably have as well to augment the full compliance requirement. And I think cyber insurance is a, like you said, it's a growing and dynamic world, because, you know, we're starting to see them say, like, they're not going to pay out on certain attacks anymore. And I think that that's, you know, why people had it to kind of live through a breach. And I think it's one of those where I think some organizations might have been using it too heavily as a risk mitigation tool. They said,
exactly,
like, okay,
yeah,
we have cyber insurance, so we don't need to worry about data protection. You know, if our data gets leaked, then we just, you know, call up the insurance and we're good, right? They're going to make us whole. But both the insurance companies and, in my mind, just being a practitioner, it's like, well, that's a weird approach to say, right? Like, just wait for it to happen. Well, we know it's going to happen. We know a breach is going to happen. And if you have no tools in place, man, that blast radius is going to be massive compared to if you took the time and the effort to actually put the correct tools in place, put the correct controls in place. That blast radius is going to be much smaller, and you're probably going to have a lot easier time getting that claim and showing it, and now that's almost becoming the requirement, right? Because these insurance companies are like, hey, wait a second. You can't just, like, say that you've got us in place and do nothing. This isn't just, you know, the only thing you can do. You've actually got to start putting some tools in place.
Right. Now, the last And before we wrap up our show, one last question. It's about the cloud and cloud security. When COVID-19 hit, that's when the big migration to the cloud really happened, I think. You know, the main choices before then or even back then were either public cloud or private cloud. Now, it seems like, you know, Azure, Google Cloud, and I think even AWS now, they're really pushing the hybrid cloud environment, which kind of brings the best of both worlds together. But with the hybrid cloud, there is more security risks. So what are your thoughts on that, especially when it comes to, like, data leakage and data storage issues in that regard?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the products that I mentioned was that data security posture management, DSPM. And there were some tools that came before that are like your more of your cloud native application protection platforms. There's a lot of vendors and innovation in that space as well. I think a combination of both of those are critical if you're either in the hybrid cloud deployment model or you're moving towards it. And the reason I think that one of those tools is needed is, first off, you need to get an understanding of what data is out there, where it lives, where it's being stored. And one of the interesting aspects that I've been reading about a lot lately is one of the new bigger challenges is, like, developers are developing apps at such a rapid rate that the amount of new buckets and new places that data is being stored isn't necessarily all part of a scan. So one of these tools have started adding in, which I think is very it's great that they've been doing this, is they're now not just looking at, okay, we know that there's all these, you know, buckets out here, but they're also scouring your cloud to look for new databases, new buckets, new places that data could be stored. And once it finds that, it says, like, oh, look, we found this new database. You should probably start scanning it. And then you could start looking inside of it and seeing, oh, yeah, look, we've got this new location of interest that, you know, we need to keep this data, at least know that there's sensitive data stored in here, and watch how people are interacting with it. I think the other aspect of it that, you know, I think, you know, this is where we come into play is when developers are moving data to and from the cloud, that you need to make sure that they're moving it into the correct cloud. So make sure that they're moving it into the corporate AWS versus you know, a private AWS or a private GCP, or if they're taking an example of this that I read about actually was, you know, if there's, let's say, a compliance requirement that your compliance data must be living in a location in, let's say, AWS that is known and is being scanned, then that bucket is where compliance data needs to go. So let's say someone downloads, let's say, a report, and it has PII data in it, and they try to re-upload that, let's say, to a new app within AWS, well, that could have a new backend to it. And so there's a lot of those interesting dynamics that I think come into play with the cloud and the rapid development of apps in there that does absolutely pose a risk. And I think that tools that either do the scanning to understand where the data is and where it's going and how it's being accessed, I think that that's like a critical aspect of securing these. And then the other side of it is if you come around and say, oh, well, once that data is downloaded from the cloud down to the workstation, provide, you know, bringing in a vendor like ourselves, like Cyberhaven, to then protect that data, it would be the other side of that of saying, like, oh, well, what happens once it's outside of the cloud, sitting down at the workstation? How do we actually provide some protections around that? I think that those two are, you know, probably the first starting points for any cloud and hybrid cloud security deployment.
Yeah, excellent. As we wrap up our show, Brian, what's the best way for someone from the audience or anybody who's interested in your services to contact you?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find me on LinkedIn. Brian Heilman, you'll see me on there. I work, again, at Cyberhaven. I also have some other things listed on my profile, like DLP test. And if you want to learn more about Cyberhaven or check out a demo of our product, you can just go to cyberhaven.com. There's a request for demo action right there, so you can, you know, reach out to us, and we'll also be at, you know, some of the major conferences like RSA, which is coming up here pretty quickly here in the end of the month.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Cool. Well, Brian, we thank you very much for your time this afternoon, this going to morning into the afternoon. We hope to have you again on a future podcast. Data privacy, data protection, that's going to be a huge hot button topic, I think, for the, you know, for the remaining coming years. So we'd love to have you again and chat more about it.
Absolutely. I appreciate you having me on, and thanks for the invite, and look forward to speaking again soon.
All right. Take care. Have a great rest of the day.
You too.